Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, I just said, where do we start after the day that we've just had here at Wimbledon? And Matt Roberts in front of me said, well, I think we better start with the match that we've just witnessed between Rafael Nadal and Nick Kyrgios. And he's got a decent point. First of all, though, let's say hello to Philip Studd, special guest here on the Tennis Podcast.
Thank you for having me, David.
It's an absolute joy. Phil is somebody that I've known for a long, long time, has been a colleague of mine on BBC Radio for many, many years, and is just a generally top bloke. And I do say that when he's not sitting in front of me as well.
Gee, thanks, Mum.
Yeah. He didn't pay me or anything. Yeah, we have so much to get through today. This one could overrun a little bit, folks. Usually we try to do half an hour for these daily shows. No time limit on this one particularly because it's just been the most extraordinary day. We will start with Nadal and Kyrgios. We'll talk about Angelique Kerber, the defending champion, going out. We'll talk about Ash Barty's form from earlier in the day when I just couldn't believe how well she played. That feels a bit like about 3 weeks ago. It's been such a long day. But we sit here at the moment where we were last night on the picnic table under dark skies now, darkening skies certainly, because it is, as we come to you, 9:26 at night. We've just wolfed down pizza whilst perusing the press conference transcripts of Rafael Nadal and Nick Kyrgios. Nick Kyrgios giving one of the most fascinating press conferences I think I've ever read. But the match itself, it was, I would say, just about everything we hoped it would be in many ways. I mean, whether you wanted Nick Kyrgios to win or Rafael Nadal to win, it started, I think we were a bit worried, Phil, that we might be in for a bit of a damp squib at the start because Nadal went 3-love up and Kyrgios looked all over the place. But then things changed.
I can't recall being as excited watching a match at Wimbledon for many a long year. To me, that was absolutely the reason why I fell in love with tennis in the first place. It brought back memories of watching McEnroe and Connors in the early 80s, who, as we know, were not the best of friends, but generated a fantastic rivalry through the sheer quality of their tennis, their contrasting characters, the fact that the crowd would pull for one or the other. And today, I mean, there was a real palpable tension in the air. You could tell how psyched up Nadal was for this match. From the very first point, he was determined to make a point. Because, of course, he lost in quite sensational circumstances in Acapulco to Kyrgios this year. He had three points.
You were commentating on that, weren't you?
I mean, it was the most incredible finale. Kyrgios lost the first set. He had no right to win the final set tiebreak. Nadal had chances to close it out. Kyrgios produced some of his audacious winners. The crowd were going absolutely bonkers. We saw the underarm serving, which obviously didn't go down well with Rafa. And Kyrgios came out on top. And I'll never forget the look of sheer thunder on Nadal's face as he left the court that night. He was absolutely livid. Not just that he'd lost, having had match points, but because he'd lost to Kyrgios in the manner in which he did. And I think today, from the moment the draw was announced, he would have been absolutely geared up to exact revenge. And he played an incredible high level. And he had to. And that was the thing. Kyrgios played an outstanding match himself. And as you say, there were doubts about whether he could produce that because many times this season, many times throughout his career, he's just not shown up. And it's been all about the controversy and what he's been saying to the umpire and the crowd and himself, rather than the brand of his tennis. But today, he played a very high-level match, but Nadal was just a bit too good for him.
Yeah, and it was a match of many, many parts today, Matt, wasn't it?
It's one of those matches that does bring into focus
what we want out of tennis, because that would have been a good match anyway. Like, we would have been interested in Kyrgios Nadal, but the fact that there was needle and there was that simmering underlying tension just made everyone even more invested in it, which I thought was really interesting. And the way Nadal came out firing, you know, he went 3-0 up, didn't he? We're playing really well, and he was on it. Kyrgios wasn't. That actually, my mind went to Thomas Burdick rather randomly, because do you remember in Madrid in 2006 when Thomas Burdick shushed the crowd in Madrid after he played Nadal? And that took his head-to-head record against Nadal to 3-1 at that point. Burdick led the head-to-head. Nadal then won their next 17 or 18 matches. He does not forget Rafael Nadal. No. He was out for revenge today, from the off.
An elephant.
The way he celebrated at the end of the first set, which he won, I mean, you'd have thought he'd have won the title. And the way he celebrated at the end of the match, the actual handshake was perfectly polite. There was no aggro at the net. But the minute that he'd acknowledged Kyrgios, he absolutely went for it, didn't he? The big fist pumps to the crowd, to his box. I mean, he was saying, I'm the boss. Never mind Acapulco. This is Wimbledon, and I'm the man with all the Grand Slams. Yeah. And he's the man with the potential who'll never realise it because he hasn't got the dedication and the passion for the sport that he needs.
The finger wag was reminiscent of Federer in that match against Djokovic in 2011 when Djokovic had won, 45 matches in a row, and then Federer took him out and wagged the finger. And, I mean, just to, if you didn't get a chance to see the whole match, or just as a brief recap, as Phil was saying there, Nadal won that first set, and then Kyrgios started to lose it, quite honestly, with the umpire. He was getting really miffed at the time that Nadal was taking between points. Obviously, Kyrgios wants to take 4 seconds. Nadal wants to take 15 minutes. And they just, as Kyrgios quite rightly says, we are polar opposites. That's just the way it is. And his analysis, his self-analysis of the two players is spot on in just about every way when you read his post-match transcript. And so the aggro, the unpleasantness between them, and yet it wasn't really ugly, but it was just that cackling tension in the air between them, as that you just felt as though literally anything could happen, that this could end up being a straightforward win for Nadal. It could be Kyrgios just taking off and putting Nadal off and winning himself straightforwardly. It could be a disqualification. There was an unsportsmanlike conduct warning for Kyrgios. He levelled the match at one set all, having really given Damien Demersois, the umpire, an absolute earful. There was a moment where twice, in fact, Kyrgios hit underarm serve winners. One of them was an ace, an underarm serve winner ace drop shot. And he also tried to hit Nadal twice with full-blooded, flat as pancakes forehand drives at the chest, and there's no getting around it. He was trying to physically hit him with the ball, and one time he nearly hit him in the head, and then the second time he hit his racket. And Nadal has had one or two things to say about that in the press conference afterwards. And Kyrgios was asked, "Why didn't you apologise?" He said, "Why should I apologise? You know, did you try to hit him?" "Yeah, I did try to hit him. You know, he can take it. He's a multiple Grand Slam winner with loads of money in the bank, you know. He can handle it." And he says, "Why should I apologise? Perfectly good tactic." And he, after he hit one into Nadal's stomach, the hardest forehand I think I've ever seen, he stood there with Nadal glaring at him, and Kyrgios was just spinning the racket in his hands, round and round and round, like a gunslinger.
It was like Clint Eastwood in a spaghetti western, wasn't it?
It was
extraordinary, because Nadal's glare was a picture, and it was as though he was waiting for Kyrgios. He was saying, "Dare you not apologise to me for that?" And of course, as you say, not only did Kyrgios not apologise, it was like, "Well, come on then, if you want some, let's go for it."
Then it seemed to me, I don't know what you think, Matt, but it seemed to me that Kyrgios just then knuckled down and played normal tennis for the next two sets, both of them tie breaks. You came up with that astonishing statistic that Nadal had lost all five of their tie breaks previously, and then he won the next two that won him this match. And Catherine, who's not here with us tonight, but she was texting us saying, "I think Kyrgios has got his tactics wrong here in sets 3 and 4. He needs to start clowning a bit more. He needs to get back in his head."
Yeah, well, his craziest set was the second set, and that was the one he won. And it makes sense that when Kyrgios plays like that, he wins, because Nadal is all about control, isn't he? And when Kyrgios is being Kyrgios. He's a disruptive force. And Nadal admitted in his Flash interview, I think it was, that he did get distracted by Nick Kyrgios versus Damien Dumasoir, which was the sort of second match that was taking place on centre court. It was one of those matches where you couldn't go to the loo during the changeovers because the back and forth between Kyrgios and the umpire was just as enthralling as the tennis.
It's true, actually. When you looked out into centre court, I mean, bear in mind this is going past 7 o'clock in the evening, and a lot of the time you'll find people say, you know what, I've had a lot of tennis today, that's enough for me, I'll go home, or that third set tie break, oh dear, I must go to the loo, or I need some dinner. Nobody left. Nobody did anything. And we were basically getting told, don't go to the travel and the news because this is too good. And which I don't think I've ever really experienced anything quite like that. I mean, certainly not for a second round.
And I have to say, with those tie breaks that you mentioned that Nadal won, my mind went to a recent quote from the US women's football head coach who said, some teams visit pressure and we live there. And I just thought, what a great quote that is, because Kyrgios is the kind of person who occasionally shows up, but Nadal shows up every single match. He is so used to dealing with the pressure, and Kyrgios couldn't quite turn it on in those tie breaks, but Nadal, because his level is so high throughout the whole match, he's able to deal with those moments so well, and he really stepped up.
Just to give you an idea of the lateness of the hour here, we can now see all the lights of centre court and court number one just starting to really come to the fore, and the skies are darkening. It is now, what time is it, 9:35 in the evening, and Boris Becker and Kim Clijsters, I think fresh from the Today at Wimbledon studio on BBC TV, have just walked past, and Boris Becker gave us a little wave, which is very nice. They would have all been cackling at this, wouldn't they? Because you quite rightly mentioned Connors and McEnroe, but Becker used to do all this stuff as well. He was full of glares in the direction. You don't see that these days.
And I think we need more of it. And that's why I think Nick Kyrgios is good news. Yes, some of his behaviour at times definitely goes beyond the acceptable line. There's no question about that. And it's too simplistic, isn't it, to just be critical of Kyrgios, because I know you've talked about it on the podcast in the past, that beneath that veneer of indifference and kind of arrogance is someone who is probably battling issues, you know, maybe depression, maybe just a lack of identity, of really understanding who he is. He's got this extraordinary talent and he's not quite sure how to deal with it in the limelight. But in terms of the theatre that those two players were able to generate today and the interest that it created, I mean, as you say, the place was just buzzing. There was not a spare seat to be had. No one knew what was going to happen next. The tennis was of the very highest calibre for a lot of that match. That is precisely what this game needs, and arguably needs a lot more of it. You know, you could say that things have become a bit too sanitised in tennis in the last 20 years or so. Everything from the surfaces that have become quite generic in terms of the fact that, you know, they all kind of play the same, to the politeness amongst the game's best. You know, this Nadal talks about respect, and he did again in the press conference after the match. Perhaps there's a bit too much respect. You know, we need a bit more aggro, quite frankly. You know,
you've come to the right place.
We're not talking about boxing gloves on the court, but there's nothing wrong with a rivalry that goes beyond polite. You know, a bit of needle is what generates interest in sport, in any sport, I think. That's when people really sit up and take notice. People who are little interested in the sport will then become engaged by a storyline, by two guys, in this case, who don't necessarily see eye to eye, who are polar opposites in the way they approach their sport, their professionalism, but who have enormous talents and can combine to produce something truly memorable. And no one who watched this afternoon's match on centre will forget it.
No.
Because it was just so compelling to watch.
Yeah, I do feel, though, I have thought for a little while now with Kyrgios that watching back his 2014 match against Nadal here, actually, it turned out, aside from the first two sets when Kyrgios was basically doing what he's been doing all year, which is just falling out with everybody, sets 3 and 4 were a throwback to the performance he put in 2014. It's just that he happened to win the two tiebreaks that time rather than lose them. And we have seen that rarely in recent years. A player who will come out and play big tennis, powerful tennis, try to overwhelm an opponent, and yes, throw some tricks in, and etc. as well. These days, it's become circus more than sport in the world of Nick Kyrgios, and I feel as though he's ended up living up to the caricature that people have drawn of him and his most extreme tendencies. And he's seen this and he's heard it and he's listened to it for so long, and Nadal alludes to it as well in his post-match press conference, that we're all, you know, every time he does anything, it's immediately clipped and it's put out on social media and everybody laughs. And I'm the same. We all find... I watched a seven-minute highlights reel of Kyrgios' best bits from 2018, and I spent the whole thing laughing and enjoying it, loving it. But it just makes him want to do it more. Or it makes him feel like, you know, as Jimmy Connors used to say, this is what they're paid for, this is what they want, this is what I'm going to do. And I think the problem is that... the chances are we will never see him contend for titles. And he is honest about that in his post-match press conference. Again, he says, look, I'm a great tennis player. I can do all the things that these top three can do, but I don't have their professionalism. And there's no suggestion that he is intending to do anything about that, which, whilst I accept it on one level, because a night like tonight is memorable on it in its own right, I just think there's not going to be enough of these, because he won't be relevant often enough. And the fact is, he's reached two Grand Slam quarterfinals in his career, and the last one of those was 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to argue with any of that. I think ultimately it comes down to what Kyrgios truly wants. I think from an outsider's point of view, you see his talent and you're just left desperately frustrated that he appears to be underperforming, because he is not being professional in the way that the top players are. And if he were, you just wonder at what he could achieve. But ultimately, it's up to Nick, isn't it? And if he's happy with that, if he's genuinely happy to show up and entertain and make a very good financial living out of the game and have the odd highlights reel, as you've alluded to there, then that's okay, because it's his life, it's his game, it's his profession. Everyone else can feel frustrated on his behalf, but it's kind of down to him. But does he really feel that way? Is he really content at where he's at? I would suspect not, because I think some of his on-court behaviour tells me that he's actually kind of in a cryptic kind of way asking for someone to intervene and help him. That would be my view. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, who knows? Because he is very difficult to unravel, Nick Kyrgios. But I get the feeling that he would secretly like to fulfil his potential, whatever that may be. Maybe he's scared to try.
He would secretly like Andy Murray to step in and say, come on, Nick.
I'll sort you out. Isn't that intriguing? You know, Murray's alluded, hasn't he, when his career does eventually come to an end, to the possibility of coaching. We know that Kyrgios thinks the world of Murray, respects him more than anyone else in the locker room. That would be an intriguing matchup, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's just Kyrgios' talent in a way is a curse, isn't it? It's thrusted him into this world that he doesn't... I don't think he enjoys it, I really don't. But I don't think he would enjoy what it takes to fulfil that talent either.
Equally, I'm not sure he has any idea what else he should be doing.
Absolutely.
So he's here and let's just carry on and live day to day. Now, I have to say, first of all, congratulations, Rafael Nadal, because what a performance. And he is a real threat in this tournament. He's got Joe Wilfried Tsonga next. I mean, he's got a horrendous draw. We know that. But he has just played himself into form tonight, and everybody needs to watch out, is it would be my takeaway from it all. I have a number of messages of people saying, why do you spend so much time talking about Nick Kyrgios? I'm sick of it. You know, this, that, the other. Other people love it. You know, he does divide opinion. I don't feel like a day like today can be ignored, and everything that has gone with it, hence why we've just given it 18 minutes of our time. And yeah, that's probably the end of our Nick Kyrgios conversation for Wimbledon in 2019. But what a night it has been.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, what else has happened? Angelique Kerber has gone out. What on earth went on there? She went out to Lauren Davis, who was a lucky loser, who won, I think, 6-2 in the third set. And not a dissimilar sort of feeling to that exit as the one she had at the Australian Open.
Yeah, and she seems to be vulnerable to being hit off the court a little bit at the moment. I think Kerber's thing in the past has always been turning opponents' power back on them, but she seems vulnerable at the moment to just being hit through and blasted off. And it's almost as though, I watched her in Eastbourne last week against Halep, and she looked great, but it's almost as though that confidence she found there was just an illusion. It wasn't there today when she needed it, and stuck out on court two, which, defending champion out on court two, I think that's a questionable court assignment, and yeah. I felt for her out there, and there was so much else going on at the same time, it almost got a bit lost in the whole story of the day. But yeah, it's disappointing for her, and also fair play to Lauren Davis, she's a great player, great competitor, but I was looking forward to potentially seeing Kerber come up against Serena in that fourth round as well.
So this is the announcement to close the place.
Are we going to be able to get out, David?
I think we can. I think we'll find a little hedge and we can jump over it.
We can go through.
Yes,
yeah.
Matt's had experience. He's been here late at night. But yes, it is now nearly 10 o'clock at night. And that voice tells us the place is closed down for the night. And that means that Andy Murray's doubles must have just ended moments ago. His first match here in a couple of years. And he's won it with Pierre Hugobert from a set down. So we'll be seeing more of Andy Murray in the men's doubles as well. So Angelique Kerber is out. I mentioned Ash Barty has gone through, and she was... It's hard to overstate how good she was today, because she played Alison van Ooytvanck of Belgium, who is a real grass court specialist, and played beautifully herself. It was all slices and dices and chips and approaches to the net and then lobs in response and smashes. It was just an old school grass court match, and it was a joy to behold. But van Ooytvanck could not get near Barty. And Barty's now won, I think, 14 matches in a row. And she's lost one set in those 14 matches. If she doesn't win this title, it's the player who beats her who's going to win it.
Yeah, I mean, it's as though her whole mindset has been transformed by winning her first Grand Slam at the French Open. We always knew she had the game. She's got a great attitude, great work ethic. But the fact that she's now proved to herself that she can win at the very highest level, the very biggest prizes, just seems to have imbued her with that extra bit of confidence that was perhaps previously lacking. You know, they say, don't they, until you've actually won, doesn't matter how good you are, you're not sure if you're good enough to win.
Yeah.
She's proved that to herself on a surface that would not be considered her strongest. So now she comes to the grass, which seems tailor-made for the way she plays her game with the variety she's got. And she's just keeping the dice spinning, isn't she? I mean, she won the title in Birmingham. She took Eastbourne off because she's nursing a bit of a chronic arm issue. She needs to manage her fitness. But, you know, the way she started her Wimbledon campaign, I mean, you're right. She just looks bulletproof at the moment. And she's playing such a wonderful brand of tennis. It's it's hard right now to see who's going to stop her. I mean, I think a lot of people felt, look, winning the French and Wimbledon is a very rare thing, particularly when the French that you've won is your first. You know, inevitably you're going to feel a great high. Look at Halep last year. How do you deal with, you know, climbing the mountain, achieving your life's ambition, then you've got to come back down, regroup and go again? And I think a lot of people felt, particularly the strength of the women's field in terms of the number of legitimate candidates for the title, you know, how feasible was that going to be for her? Well, if the evidence of the first two rounds is anything to go by, very feasible indeed.
Well, the last player to win the French Open, a grass court tune-up event, and Wimbledon was Martina Navratilova in 1984. But
just the 35 years then.
Justine Henin, I think, came kind of close in 2007, where that wasn't the issue. She won the French in a tune-up, but then didn't do much at Wimbledon. But I just love Ash Barty because she plays points rather than shots. I always think she's always constructing a point, plotting a point, thinking a couple of shots ahead, and in a very weird way, she reminds me of the new Del Potro in the fact that there's such a discrepancy between what she's doing with her forehand, which is loopy topspin and manoeuvring all around the court, and what she's doing with her backhand, which is slice, but an aggressive slice. And I think that must be really confusing for players, because you've got two such different shots off both wings. I mean, she's not like Del Potro in any other respect at all, but that element of it does remind me of Del Potro.
Yeah, well, she's through Barty. She'll now face Harriet Dart, I think, isn't it, who got a great win today over against Beatriz Haddad-Meier, and actually another good day for British players. And one of the other players that won was Dan Evans, and he was quite brilliant today against Nicolas Basilashvili. And I ended up describing Evans as the male Ash Barty in the way that he was playing, because it was all lovely slices on the backhand. His game plan was so clever against Basilashvili today, just taking the pace off that backhand, floating it long, then knifing a backhand slice short. And the moment it got on his forehand, he exploded into his own whippy topspin.
There was something sort of Federer-erotic about it, sort of driving Basilashvili mad with that short slice and bringing him forward the way Federer used to do with Roddick. And Basilashvili is not a very good volleyer, and Evans really exposed him today by bringing him forward. And he was so emotional at the end, Dan Evans. You saw how much it meant to him, the fact that, you know, he made qualifying for Wimbledon such a goal, and he said, I really wanted to do well at Wimbledon. And given the way that his career has unfolded, the fact that, you know, and he's messed it up himself, I think he's taken a lot of strength and a lot of hard work to get back to this, and it all came pouring out of him at the end.
You know, 2 years ago when we were here, he just revealed to us all that he tested positive for cocaine, and I was sorry about the name dropping, but I was looking back at a few messages from him back then. Just almost, all I wanted to do was check on his kind of mental welfare, really, because I knew he'd got at least a year out of the sport, and I thought this guy could massively go off the rails right now, because if he hasn't got tennis in his life and he hasn't got that structure and et cetera, et cetera. And I was just a bit concerned on a human level, really, and. He had said after the day before he announced that he tested positive, he said, tomorrow my life changes. You know, tomorrow I'm screwed, basically. And I thought that was the end for him. I thought he would not make a comeback, despite trying to say, you know, it's possible. I thought it was possible, but I think he probably got a decent sentence for him. I think it probably, you know, that gave him enough. It wasn't so much time off that he could at least make a comeback as a player. But the way he's come back, to win through all those qualifying and in the challenges and, you know, get through a few rounds at the qualifying here last year but not make it, and then keep backing it up, and David Felgate giving him this incredible platform and this grueling training regime and just not taking any of his crap, frankly, and I suppose doing for him what somebody really needs to be able to do for Kyrgios that he can't find. And he looks just such a good player out here, and he now plays Joao Sousa, who beat Marin Cilic today, runner-up from a couple of years ago, and he's got a real chance of making a run here. And when you describe the emotion he showed, Evans, at the end, that's what was going through my mind, is just it must be in the back of his mind there that I thought I was finished, and here he is, you know, because he spent a couple of really miserable years, or at least 12 months, watching daytime television and being irrelevant on the tennis scene, and here he is back in the mix, so to speak.
Well, is he in the mix?
A little. Is he in the mix? Is Dan Evans in the mix?
The infamous mix. I'm still not quite sure what the mix actually is.
We're not really.
Is the mix quite, by definition, a big pool of players, or is it a very esoteric collection of players?
We described it as the group of players you would not be surprised by if they won Wimbledon.
Right.
So I think by that definition,
he's not in the mix.
Okay. But he's certainly outside of the big three. He'd be, I think Catherine said, in the top 10 of list of contenders of players who are left in the tournament.
And that's pretty amazing when you consider where he was a couple of years
somebody
ago.
Somebody said to you today, is he fourth favourite for the title?
Yeah.
He's not.
He's
he?
Not. No,
I thought that
not.
Was Felix Auger-Aliassime, who'd never won a Grand Slam match before he arrived at Wimbledon, which doesn't say a great deal, does it, for the players below the big three?
Well, I don't know, though. I think it shows just how special Auger-Aliassime is in terms of his potential, but we'll see whether he keeps going through the draw.
Well, he's on a collision course with Djokovic, of course.
Is he?
They could meet in the fourth round.
Who was ridiculously good in his previous round against Kudla.
Ridiculously good he was. Last night we were halfway through that match when it was being played, and we should say as well that after that there was a press conference that Djokovic gave in which he was grilled by the American journalist Bill Simons, who wanted to know why Djokovic appeared to still be backing Justin Gilmerstov as a friend of his and somebody he's still in touch with and somebody he advises on and somebody that might even be able to come back into position. He was grilling him as to why he would take such a position given the fact that Gilmerstov has been effectively convicted of a crime and he has been convicted of a crime, and he is serving community service, and he pleaded no contest in the court of law and had it very explicitly explained to him that that meant effectively a guilty plea, and therefore why are you backing him? And he asked Djokovic, have you read the witness statements of that case? And Djokovic said, I will read them, I haven't read them yet, which was a huge surprise to me, and I think to a lot of people, that he would be taking any sort of stance on the issue having not read those details. I am pleased that he told the moderator of the press conference not to intervene, that he heard Bill Simons out, and that he said, I will read these statements, and then we will look forward to seeing what he says in his press conference tomorrow, hopefully with that information having been consumed. So, what else has happened today? Johanna Konta has beaten Katerina Siniaková straightforwardly, which was a surprise to me. I had Siniaková winning that today. When we do our predictions for the newsletter, Phil, which I know you like to read.
Oh, I do.
Yes.
And they're normally wrong, I have to say.
They are normally wrong.
I mean, you're not having your greatest ever Grand Slam in that regard.
But you've got to understand the premise behind the predictions. It's a bit like the mix. It's not that straightforward.
No.
We're not allowed to say, I think that Novak Djokovic will beat Dennis Kudler, because that doesn't cut it.
In other words, you have to go out on a limb.
Yeah, you have to go out on a limb.
And
that's right.
People come for good predictions and stay for bad predictions.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, who wants to be right with something like this? You'd much rather be spectacularly wrong, which is where David comes in.
All we want to be is spectacular. We don't really care whether it's right, wrong, indifferent, whatever. But yeah, if you'd like to get on the newsletter, like Phil Studd, our special guest here on the Tennis Podcast, you can. Go to our social media channels, at Tennis Podcast on Twitter, and we will post a link for our newsletter, and you can sign up and get it to your inbox every single morning. Oh, by the way, leave us a review on iTunes as well, because we like that, and tell everybody you know about the Tennis Podcast so we can grow our audience. Those are our little parish notices done. Petra Kvitova won today, 7-5, 6-2 over Kristina Mladenovic, which she's shown some form, Kvitova, isn't she, given that she's been injured.
I actually watched that match.
Did you?
And she looked quite edgy right at the beginning. She was broken right at the start of the set. Mladenovic, she's got a terrible record against Kvitova. I think she's beaten her once in 8 attempts, and that was indoors about 6-7 years ago.
Mm.
And she actually had set points in the first set, Mladenovic. But you just got the feeling that that previous very negative head-to-head was weighing on her shoulders. She couldn't quite deliver the killing blow in that set. And you just sensed that once Kvitova broke back and got the first set in the bag, even though she was broken right at the start of the second, it always felt like it was her match. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? She's come into this tournament, Kvitova, off a very strong year, but with the problem with her arm, she tore a tendon in her serving arm, and she had very low expectations arriving here, and actually said, look, if it wasn't Wimbledon, I wouldn't be here.
Oh, you right. know,
I would have actually given myself a bit more rest. But of course, I don't want to miss a tournament I've won twice before and I've got such great memories of. And she's also said, if I felt any pain in the arm, I would stop because it's not worth the long-term implications of playing through a problem like that and exacerbating it. But, you know, given her game, if the arm does hold up, and the fact that she is a bit under the radar because of her injury issue coming in, I mean, what price Kvitova? Yeah, well, you know, when she's on, well, with that she, serve
yeah,
of hers.
When she's on a roll. I mean, similarly, Serena Williams, who lost the first set 6-2 today against Kaya Juvan, but eventually came back and won it 6-4 in the third. Jay Clark put up a decent performance, certainly in the second set, getting Roger Federer to a tie break on court one, which is looking pretty worn right now, inevitably, because there's a lot of tennis being played on it, including doubles now. Federer won through in straight sets in the end. What else have we had today? We've had the end of the career of Marcus Baghdatis, who played his final match against Matteo Berrettini.
And then proceeded to give all of his kit away to the audience. So the whole kit and caboodle, rackets, tennis shoes, the shoes he was wearing. He gave one to someone in the crowd, the other to someone else. Sweatbands, underwear, you know, no, probably not underwear, but you, I mean, short of actually walking off the court stark naked, he gave everything he possessed that he brought onto the court away, and the crowd were just absolutely enraptured. I mean, the ovation that he got at the end of that match went on for about 10 minutes.
Wow.
It was really quite touching, actually, and he was milking it for all it was worth, but it was a really nice moment, because I mean, what a talent he's been.
Yeah.
I mean, someone made the point in this era where Djokovic, Nadal, Federer, and to a lesser extent Murray have absolutely owned the Grand Slams. You know, to get to a final in that era, you know, to have actually made a final.
And a semi here in
06. And a semi here, a final in Australia, is a major achievement. You know, that is impressive. And such an entertaining player at his best as well, a real crowd pleaser. So that was a great moment.
Yeah, he was smiling until the end, Marcus Baghdatis. And I just think he's one of those players who has resonated beyond his achievements. I think I've got sort of friends who are casually interested in tennis. If I were to ask them to name some tennis players, I think Marcus Baghdatis would actually be quite high up their list. He's the sort of player who connects with people.
And, yeah, oh yeah. And well, I was in Australia that year that he got to the Australian Open final, commentated on the semi-final that he won against David Nalbandian to get there. And it felt like it wasn't sport. It felt like it was bigger than sport. Like there was some other force carrying him onwards. And he did. He lit the place up.
And he always had that in Australia, didn't he? Because there's a big sort of Cypriot Greek contingent
over in
Melbourne. And I always remember that match against Andre Agassi at the US Open.
Well, what a year. If you consider that he reached the final of the Australian Open. I mean, I remembered halfway through commentary today when I saw he'd lost, that he'd actually played the semis against Nadal here in 06 and that was Nadal's first final, and he'd beaten Leighton Hewitt, Baghdatis as well, to get to that point here in 06, and then that incredible match against Agassi at the US Open,
which is always kind of remembered for Andre Agassi, his last victory. But a great match takes two, and Baghdatis's role in that match was just incredible. The way he was cramping and literally couldn't move but kept going through it. And yeah, and he had that match in Australia one year with Hewitt that finished at 4:34 a.m.
Oh,
I think it's the latest ever finish at the Australian Open.
Oh, we're still up.
Yeah, he's just one of these guys who's just been involved in so many moments. And of course, we can't talk about Baghdatis without mentioning his racket smashing abilities as well.
Oh, so yes,
the iconic, not even taking them out of the plastic and just smashing them to get smithereens.
Get every racket out in his bag and smash the lot. Sloane Stephens won through. She won easily. She's going to play Jo Konta in the next round. That'll be interesting.
Konta, who's beaten Sloane Stephens 3 times out of 3 this year already.
Marmalised her at the French and just an incredible performance.
Going to be interesting.
And Sloane Stephens was asked about it and she said, yeah, it's been a rough year with Jo Konta.
We had John Isner. I was watching a bit of that match against Mikhail Kukushkin. Kukushkin beat him in 5, and Isner really didn't look fit, to be honest, out there. He ran out of gas. Fabio Fognini won in 5 as well. You were watching that, weren't you?
I was, and something that struck me as quite surprising when I was looking at the stats for Fabio Fognini is that with today's victory, and of course he beat Francis Tiafoe in 5 in the first round, he's won 20 five-set matches for Fognini, as against, I think, 13 losses in five-set matches. Now, Fabio Fognini and resilience are not necessarily words that are always found in a happy way, in a sentence, are they? You know, but that shows that actually, I don't know whether it's marriage that has given him an extra, you know, steel or resilience, but you know, he's performing well, isn't he? He's playing the tennis of his life.
Yeah.
He's top 10 in the world. He's won in Monte Carlo, biggest title.
Wow, Kiki Burton saved match point today to beat Taylor Townsend. I'm just looking at this. She won 6-2 in the third, and she was match point down.
Yeah, but did you hear about
Taylor
the match point?
Taylor Townsend,
it was unbelievable.
Will be having nightmares about the match
Why,
point.
What happened?
She had an open court.
She had an open court, mid-court forehand. She went for a drop shot, and she just dunked it into the net.
She could have put it anywhere.
Oh, dear.
And she never recovered.
That's a shame for her, isn't it? Right. Well, that kind of sums up all the results today.
Can I give a shout-out to Elise Cornet and Yelena Ostapenko?
Go on, then.
Who were having all sorts of fun out on the doubles court when everyone was watching Kyrgios and Nadal. Cornet had a volley and hit Ostapenko square at the net. And Ostapenko then had a serve a few games later. And she served and hit Cornet on the other side of the net and won the point because her serve hit Cornet on the full.
Blimey.
They were having words and aggro and tension and drama. It was hilarious.
Oh, I'm going to go and watch a replay. That's all right. Brilliant. But I have to say, it is 10 o'clock at night now, and we are sitting in virtual darkness here on a picnic table on the outskirts of Henman Hill. We can just see the lights illuminating out of court one and centre. So I'll just very quickly run you through the order of play for tomorrow, which starts with,
it is a bit of a weird one.
I actually like the matches 2 and 3, and I certainly think Kevin Anderson deserves a chance on centre court given what he did last year. But Kevin Anderson against Guido Pella is not a match I think that most centre court ticket holders were, I don't want to be rude, but they probably weren't hoping for that one necessarily as their opener. No offence to either of those players particularly, but you know. And then Simona Halep against Victoria Azarenka follows. That is going to be a barn burner.
Well, I think Azarenka will win that. I watched Simona Halep's match in the previous round and I thought she was quite ordinary, to be honest. I didn't actually see the third set because I had to rush away for what looked like the conclusion of Carl Edmund's match in 3 sets, turned out to be 5 and he lost because I was waiting to do Djokovic. But the first 2 sets, Halep was missing a lot. And Azarenka, I gather, was outstanding. So I'm going for Azarenka in that one.
What about you?
Yeah, I'll take Azarenka's form. I think 2-alls are head-to-head.
We're all going to go for Azarenka in the newsletter, aren't we? Because we can because she's the unseeded player. Polona Herzog against Coco Gauff, who has taken this tournament by storm. She's in the third match, the 15-year-old. On number one court, there is Karolina Pliskova against Shea Souway, which I have to say, I would quite like to watch that match.
Absolutely.
Especially after the aggro words of Pliskova, saying she doesn't want to practice with Shea because she wants to play proper tennis.
1998, Jana Novotna, the last time that someone won Eastbourne and Wimbledon.
Yeah. That's quite a stat, isn't
it? Don't tell Karolina that.
No. Then Novak Djokovic. Well, in football parlance, they'd stick that up on the dressing room wall, wouldn't they?
Records are made to be broken.
Yeah, Novak Djokovic against, what's his first name? Hurkacz's first name.
Hubert.
All right, Hubert. You're playing Djokovic tomorrow. And then it's Felix Auger-Aliassime against, is it Hugo?
Hugo.
Humbert. Yeah.
Who was playing against Marion Airbear in the doubles, so, and Catherine described as looking like he was on a school trip.
Yes.
Ugo, he's very baby-faced.
Ugo Humbert against Pierre Ugo Airbear would stretch my...
Commentator's dream.
Yeah.
Lots of French sounds.
Court number two, Caroline Wozniacki against Zhang Shuai, Karen Khachanov against Roberto Bautista Agut, Medvedev against Goffin, and, well, there's loads of matches on. I mean, it's not as immediately thrilling an order of play tomorrow as it was today, and yet there's lots of nice little stories around that will no doubt take off. Incidentally, Jamie Murray in the doubles will resume 2-1 up, he and Neil Skupski against Dodig and Polisic.
I'm on 12-all final set tiebreak watch with Riley Opelka versus Milos Raonic. In fact, I think we should probably just skip there now, to be honest.
Yeah. Fast forward.
Yeah,
I heard your debate about exactly how tall Opelka now is and whether he's grown some in the last few months. Well, the latest I read is he's 11'3" in his socks. But that may have changed in the time since I read that.
Well, if he'd have eaten our pizza right now, he'd have definitely gone over the 7-foot barrier.
And we've got Murray and Serena tomorrow.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But when's that on?
That's to be arranged.
Oh, yeah.
So that will... I think it could well go on to centre with the two women's matches there. You'd maybe expect that to go more quickly than one which has got two men's matches.
Okay. Right. Okay, well, fine, folks. I'm going to let you get to bed now because it's 10:15 at night and we are literally sitting in total darkness, probably locked in. So we'll see if we can go and put our heads down for the night somewhere, maybe under that picnic table over there. You can have that one, I'll have this one. And we'll be back tomorrow with another tennis podcast brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com with our mascot Rio with a Y. Thanks for listening to us every night, folks. We love doing it. We hope you're enjoying it. Tell everybody you know, because then we'll have more listeners and we love it. So we'll speak to you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.